And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, Executive Director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, which just released the report Green, a Shock Doctrine, and runs the climateconnections.org blog, commented that the massive People's Climate March brought together a diverse mix of constituencies from anti-capitalist to indigenous peoples to representatives from communities impacted by climate change, both in the U.S. and around the world. Each had their own set of demands, but the overarching theme was the need to build power from the grassroots and stop relying on governments and the UN to do this for us. And we're delighted to have with us Ann Peterman.
Thanks for having me on.
And you have done some really good moving and shaking, and part of that was expressed with the Flood Wall Street action, in which, aside from a group of polar bear suited individuals who were arrested, many others who took the struggle directly to Wall Street and corporations. And why do you think that's so important and not just pleading with the UN and Ban Ki-moon to come up with a resolution? And we can talk about what came out of the General Assembly. So why is the Flood Wall Street action so critical?
Well, we really have to take the focus away from the puppets, which, you know, I consider the UN and the U.S. government essentially puppets for the power elite, the corporations that are planning to make a lot of money off of climate change. And so we have these proposals going through the UN. You had Ban Ki-moon, you know, embracing business. You know, Richard Branson talking about how wonderful it was going to be to make all this money off of climate change. And so, you know, we see all these false solutions coming out of the United Nations pushed by these corporate groups in the background. And that's why we can't rely on them. I've been going to the UN Climate Convention since 2004 and just seen firsthand how they're completely dominated by these corporate interests and have the space for civil society, for organizations, for indigenous peoples, for social movements to engage, get squeezed smaller and smaller and smaller until it's basically non-existent at this point. And so taking it straight to those corporations, to those bankers, to those financiers has been, I think, crucial to point the finger at who's really driving this problem and at who's really pushing these false solutions that are going to just make the problem worse, even though they may sound green and pretty, but they're really just going to make the problem worse, like biofuel, for example.
The phrase greenwashers has entered the lexicon to describe those who tinker around the edges of climate change. So who are the real culprits of climate change? If you can continue to elaborate on that, and by all means, do get into the biofuel issues.
Sure. Well, at the Rio Plus 20 summit in 2012, one of the big things that was featured there was Ban Ki-moon's Sustainable Energy for All initiative, which sounds really great. Okay, sustainable energy for all, that's perfect. But actually what he was talking about was all options on the table. So no energy option was taken off the table. His Sustainable Energy for All initiative included fracked gas, it included nuclear power, it included these enormous hydroelectric projects. In fact, there was one that was featured, which was a big dam in Brazil in the Amazon that was going to be flooding vast expanses of forest, displacing indigenous peoples. This was called, you know, one of the great sustainable energy projects, similar projects, a hydroelectric project in Quebec. You know, these are not sustainable energies, and biofuels is one that's been getting quite a bit of attention over the past, decade. And in not so positive ways. So, you know, we've seen about 30% of the U.S. corn crop going into ethanol, which has been driving up food prices around the world, driving up levels of starvation, taking over land all over the globe for these biofuels. We can't replace the amount of fossil fuels we're using now with biofuels, bioenergy of any kind, whether it comes from corn, sugar cane, trees, soybeans. We just can't do it. There's not enough land A scientist friend calculated that if we were to replace the amount of fossil fuels with bioenergy, we would require about 6 planets worth of land to do that. So just replacing a tiny fraction, you know, about 10% of renewable energy in some countries in Europe is coming from bioenergy, has driven massive land grabs around the world, displacements of people, destruction of forests. It's been really terrible, and terrible for the climate, too. You can't have all of this land conversion and expect that we can actually successfully deal with climate change. It's really moving us in just exactly the wrong direction.
So you're talking about the bioenergy, the hydroelectricity, the nuclear power, and even the industrial-scale wind farms are part of what you're saying are driving land grabs, and of course, with that, enormous consequences for, I guess, indigenous people and peasants, all of that.
Yes, exactly. There's an industrial-scale wind farm in southern Mexico that is being heavily opposed by the peasant farmers that live there because they're being pushed off their land for this huge wind power project that is in part going to be providing electricity for a Heineken facility. You know, and there's a lot of fossil fuels that are required to create these industrial wind farms to drive these different false solutions. They don't just magically pop up by themselves. A lot of fossil fuels are required to construct them. So what we're saying is let's figure out a way, before we start talking about substituting for fossil fuels, let's figure out how first we're going to restructure our society so that we can cut our use of energy by about 90%. That's what climate scientists say we need to do, cut our use of energy by about 90%. And then that remaining 10%, we can figure out some alternative ways that are actually sustainable, that are actually in line with what the ecosystem and the bioregion that we're in can sustain.
And I'm just interested in your thoughts on the General Assembly completed its summit meeting with the largest number of leaders from around the world that it has ever had to presumably respond to the imperative to deal with the carbon emissions in the climate. And there was a promise extracted from China, for example, that it would curb its carbon emissions by 2020. And, of course, this is in preparation for two major world events that are coming up later in this year and the next. Is Ban Ki-moon a greenwasher allied with business? Is this essentially a pharic victory, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, definitely. You know, they're not talking about real change. They're talking about Band-Aids. They're talking about, you know, how do we continue with business as usual under a green veneer? How do we make it sound like we've done something useful? The definitions are extremely vague, you know, when they talk about how we're going to actually cut carbon emissions. And as I mentioned, many false solutions are often included in that, which can include, you know, so-called clean coal and bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, which essentially means you continue to put out carbon emissions, but you then supposedly capture them and store them underground, even though that technology doesn't actually exist and there's no way to guarantee that you can keep the carbon underground, you know, in the face of, oh, let's say, an earthquake, which could release it all back into the atmosphere. And so, yeah, these crazy schemes that they're coming up with to supposedly address climate change while really just providing an excuse to continue business as usual and these booming economies and so on, giving them an excuse to keep going, which even though all evidence to the contrary, if the economy keeps growing, climate change will continue to get worse.
So the United Nations has effectively been under the control or captured by the plutocracy and is not the venue to look towards for activists who are seeking to save our planet, essentially.
Right, and that's why Flood Wall Street was so important, was people taking action into their own hands and going and really expressing their outrage directly to the source. And I think that's what we need to see more of is people taking their frustrations directly to the people responsible. And I was really hopeful when I sat in on some of the direct action trainings and saw that there were so many new people, people who had never done an action like that before, who had never been arrested before, who were willing to risk arrest. And in New York City, that's no small thing, where you can be held in jail for up to 3 days, you know. And so people who are really willing to risk their comfort zones to get out there in the streets and take action, that made me really feel optimistic about the possibility for real change in the future, that people were willing to do that.
What is the process for mobilizing against and eroding the business and corporate control over our planet? Short of the obvious, rhetorical advocacy for dismantling capitalism, which I'm not sure we have time to wait for.
Well, but we may not have time to wait for it, but we also don't have any time to not do it, right? So, I mean, there has to be a fundamental shift in how we live on this planet, and that we really don't have an option there. It's either change how we live on the planet, or the planet's going to say, well, you know what, it's time for the human epoch to be finished. But so we really do have to figure out how to do that, and people are doing it all over the world. There are societies that live with the planet and not on the planet, right? So it is possible, and there are lots of examples. There are lots of people implementing real solutions. And as I said, people starting to beginning the process of stopping the compliance with the system, as we saw on Flood Wall Street, and as we're seeing with these peasant communities in Honduras that are fighting oil palm plantations in Indonesia, who are fighting oil palm plantations in Mexico, fighting industrial wind farms. There are people who are resisting all over the world, and if we see more of that in this country, I think we'll start to really challenge the power structure that's driving climate change. This is, after all, the belly of the beast.
You said it to some extent, but I just want to press on it. Without romanticizing primitive communalistic societies, how do we really reimagine and structure the way we live on this planet? Why isn't it just a matter of simple substituting renewable energy for fossil fuels and carrying on business as usual?
Well, there's no way to sustainably substitute fossil fuels with any kind of renewables at the rate that they're being consumed at this point. So, as I said, first we have to figure out how to cut our energy use by about 90%, and I don't see how business as usual is possible and still be able to do that. And you especially have to do the carbon accounting, that's what it's called, the carbon accounting for these renewable energies, to see just how effective they are at addressing climate change and at stopping carbon emissions. And if you look at the full-scale carbon accounting of, let's say, wood-based bioenergy, you find out that, in fact, the amount of carbon that's being put out by the supposedly alternative to coal, which is burning wood, is actually more. So when you burn wood, there's actually more emissions going out than when you burn coal. So that's clearly not a solution, even though it's being pushed as one. And the same, as I mentioned before, with biofuels, you know, hydroelectric dams put out enormous amounts of methane. And we really have to look at the whole picture of what we're doing and give it some serious thought and start having solutions coming from the grassroots. Because this top-down paradigm is just plain old, you know, not working, it's driving us to extinction.
You talked a moment ago, and let's flesh it out further, how people around the world are already implementing real solutions to the climate crisis and living in a sustainable relationship with the Earth. Give us some ideas of some of those places, some of those societies where that has begun to happen and are models that we can think about pressing forward on.
Well, you touched on it earlier. I mean, there are indigenous communities all over the world who have not gotten trapped into the capitalist culture, who continue to know how to live on the land, who provide concrete examples of how that can be done. But there are also peasant communities. La Via Campesina is a peasant movement, a global peasant movement. Millions of peasant farmers are involved in this, and one of their slogans is "Small farmers cool the planet." And what they mean by that is the small-scale agriculture that they're promoting, that they're implementing, is really part of the solution to climate change, because industrial agriculture puts out enormous carbon emissions from beginning to end, and not just carbon, but also other emissions like nitrogen that are big greenhouse gas trappers as well. Sunlight trappers as well. And so they have a lot of concrete solutions, and there are millions of people implementing these, you know, this organic farming, this small-scale farming around the world. So that's a very concrete example of how we can feed ourselves and be cooling the planet at the same time, and on and on. I mean, I couldn't possibly name them all, but there are I was involved with the international climate justice movement for many years, and many of the folks who are involved in these real solutions would come to some of these UN events, and we would sit down and we would talk about what these real solutions look like. And there are many, many of them, and they're largely being driven by local communities, grassroots organizations, and social movements.
How do you understand the importance, the effectiveness, shall we say, of the legions that came out for the People's Climate March, estimated at minimally 310,000, many of whom who have certainly not taken their knowledge to the degree that you have, and indeed think it's about essentially bioenergy and hydroelectricity and some alterations with using fundamentally those methods advocated by now many clever corporate entities. What was accomplished? Where, perhaps a better way of saying it is, do you see taking that energy and molding it to a more militant and more militant imperative to work more quickly and more effectively to deal with the perversion, really, and destruction of our climate?
Sure. Well, there were a lot of issues that people brought up with the climate march and the way it was organized and the sort of broad lack of message that came out of it beyond just, let's take some action on climate change without defining in any way what that was. But the one positive thing that came out of it was that, you know, people did come who do have a more radical analysis. There was a what was called a climate convergence conference that happened just before it, where people with a largely critical analysis and anti-capitalist analysis, an analysis looking for real solutions, came together from all different walks of life, all different backgrounds, to talk about how we could start putting aside our differences and figuring out what our common root causes or our root enemies, for lack of a better word, are, that we can really confront to start dealing with this problem. Because if you look at the root causes of climate change being this, you know, this power elite, this corporate dominated society, you find out that that's the same thing that is driving many of the issues that lots of people are concerned about. I mean, it's the same system that drove what we saw in Ferguson just recently. It's the same system that's driving injustice, not only in the United States, but across the planet, that's oppressing workers, that's oppressing women. It's all, if you look at the roots, they're all the same. So we all have something to gain from addressing the root causes of climate change. And that was something that I saw that came out of the fact that so many people came to New York for that climate march. People started talking about that. And then, of course, where the Wall Street actions the next day.
One of the things that I didn't see and distresses me when that mobilization occurs and those numbers of people come together with such good energy and good feeling and spirit of community and issue is that, okay, you hit the buses and you travel on home. There was no conclusion. There was no sense of gathering people together, continuing the process. Most people just boarded their buses and returned to their place of origin, so to speak. And so what can you tell us about follow-up and how people can get on board a bus that has a further distance to travel and meet up with like-minded people to really incorporate the issue of climate into whatever work they do, because the imperative is too important not to respond to. Didn't happen at the march, so what do we do?
Right. Well, that's the big challenge, right? It's now that we've returned home.
And I laid it all at your feet.
That's right. So now that we've returned home to our communities, how do we keep the momentum building? And I think each community is going to be unique in the challenges that it's facing, you know, whether it's folks in the, you know, in West Virginia who are banding together to deal with mountaintop removal coal mining, or people who are banding together to deal with whatever issue they are, to incorporate the climate into some of the messaging that people are involved with, and just to really start questioning when you have the Environmental Defense Fund or Conservation International saying that, oh yeah, we can stop climate change and all we have to do is, you know, change our light bulbs and switch to ethanol in our cars and it'll be all fine, is to really start questioning that. And if you look on the boards of directors and you find out all the corporations that are represented there, well, hey, you find out why these folks are pushing these false solutions the way that they are. So there has to be a challenging of the misinformation campaigns and, you know, looking around to find out where the real information is. Our climate-connections.org blog is a one place that people can start. We try to put up articles about real struggles around the planet, real issues, real root causes, so people can start understanding what those are. There are lots of different blogs that do that. And so I think that's a great place to start. And then figuring out how you can implement it in your own community. Who are the people that are out there that you can band together with? This is not new. I mean, this happened in the Vietnam War movement. It happened in the Civil Rights Movement. People getting together and figuring it out for themselves and deciding what they need to do in their own communities to make real change. So I know it can be done because it's been done time and time again in this country by different movements. And people do achieve the impossible, and they have done it on many occasions.
And I want people to check out the just-released report, Green Shock Doctrine. And you can go to the website of Global Justice Ecology Project, and you can check out climateconnections.org, the blog. And Peterman, thanks for the work you do. Thanks for doing the moving and shaking, organizing around the issues of climate change, but doing some moving and shaking and driving us to a more militant, necessary position to confront the plutocracy that is indeed the source of destruction of our planet. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
Give your hands to struggle. Give your hands to struggle.
One day after New York City's largest climate march in history, thousands of protesters rallied near Wall Street to highlight the financial industry's role in fueling industries responsible for the air pollution that is causing global warming and climate change. The action came ahead of the one-day United Nations Climate Summit, where leaders from 125 countries took part in the first high-level climate talks since Copenhagen nearly 5 years ago. Dubbed Flood Wall Street, hundreds of protesters dressed in blue held a rowdy sit-in on Broadway, just blocks from the U.S. Stock Exchange. The demonstrators occupied the street for more than 8 hours until police began arresting some 100 people.
Responding to a protest yesterday about climate change and targeting the companies that profit off of climate change.
The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching! that infectious spirit and energy that the protesters here and the organizers of this have brought to the movement, I think is really what it's going to take. I mean, yesterday's march was absolutely uplifting. I came from Nevada for it. It's great. But I think more and more tactics like these are going to be critical to really shake up the system to get the fundamental transformational changes that we need.
It was at times very scary. Pepper spray was used again, which brings back a lot of bad memories. They just took about 5 vans, including an entire bus of people, to different precincts. They won't even tell us which precincts. So now everyone's shifting into jail support and court support instead of being out here. They were arrested on the grounds of blocking traffic. So that is why, for instance, the NYPD left anybody alone that was standing on this side of the police barricades.
We try really hard to get the names and information of people who plan to be arrested beforehand, so that, you know, you can kind of keep track of them. Plan an action like was planned today. It's not actually over until everyone who got arrested is out of jail. Not like when we all go home, not when the paddy wagons get loaded up. It's not done until everyone's out of jail.
Wall Street serves Manon, you know, to make money. People be damned. And the nexus with climate is Wall Street also exists to make money, and the whole planet be damned. I mean, you know, major corporations that are part of Wall Street are going to lose money when we get a handle on the climate crisis, and they don't want to do that. And so the idea is that people are more important than the corporate profits, and that's the nexus between Occupy and the climate.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.